Good morning. I thank you all for coming to this session. I'm speaking about Christian humanitarian engineering, and that will take some definition as to what do I mean by that, because not everybody will agree that such a thing even exists. So my name is Bill Jordan, and I am at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. Excuse me. My background for this is I've been interested in a long time and using engineering skills to help poor people in the developing world. So on a regular basis, I take groups of engineering students into the developing world and work on projects. I've been to Kenya and Tanzania once, Honduras once. I've been to Rwanda, and I hope to go again. And this May, I and another professor led a group into Haiti. But I also have an interest in theology. I became a Christian while I was a junior at the Colorado School of Mines, and all this was new to me, so before I continued on with my engineering career, I took a two-year detour and got a Master of Arts degree from Denver Seminary. Much of this presentation is a result of my trying to integrate two very different sets of concepts. About last fall, I ran into this book, Humanitarian Engineering. It's not a very long book. I read it in one weekend by Carl Mitchum and David Munoz from the Colorado School of Mines, which is actually where I went to school, but they started there long after I left. I was really fascinated by what they had to say. And it's also stimulated by a book I read a long time ago and I've just recently reread, Christ and Culture by Richard Niebuhr. And I think this is a remarkable book that gives me insight into this whole discussion. Now, for those of you who are in technology, you will find Humanitarian Engineering a very easy read. It's about 70 pages. This, to be honest, for a non-professional theologian, is a relatively difficult book, but it's very, very insightful. When I read that book this last fall, I was really astounded, because I knew of a few other people who were doing what we're doing at Baylor, but I didn't realize how widespread it is, not just in Christian circles, but also in secular circles as well. And they were describing and giving names and terms to a lot of things that I was already doing. Later this spring, I had a chance to have lunch with Carl Mitchum when he visited the Baylor University, and we had a very interesting discussion. They have developed what they call humanitarian engineering, and you think of different engineering disciplines. At the Carter School of Mines, you can't get a major in this yet, but you can get a minor in humanitarian engineering as a discipline. And that's something that several professors are exploring at Baylor, and I hope that we can have that as at least an option within our discipline programs within the next year or two. So we need to look at some terms, and this is from Mitchum and Munoz's book, so we have a common frame of reference. Humanitarian, they say, is to promote present and future well-being for the direct benefit of underserved populations. So that doesn't necessarily mean engineering. It can mean engineering. It can mean healthcare. It can mean lots of different things, education. Now, this is their definition for engineering. You may have, if you're an engineer, a slightly different definition. But this is reasonable. They're saying we need to design things under physical, political, culture, ethical, legal, environmental, and economic constraints. If any of you are engineering professors, that sounds a lot like some things in ABET about how we need to do design. They say humanitarian engineering, and this is a quote, I didn't put quotation marks, but this is from their book, it's a design under constraints to directly improve the well-being of underserved populations. So again, there's a lot of things we could do culturally and legally and educationally to help poor people in the United States, for sure, that doesn't involve engineering. But they're talking about designing under constraint. That's at heart of really what I think engineers do. But you're having a particular goal with underserved populations. These concepts are not really new. The term is new, but helping poor people through engineering is not new. Certainly one of the things that's been fascinating to me as someone interested in engineering ethics is how the codes of conduct have changed over the years. And certainly by the 60s, they almost all included the public safety, health, and welfare of the public. And then we've seen sustainability now get into most of the engineering codes, for example. But there, people talked about this a long time ago. This is a quote from this book, which I was fascinated with. President Truman in January of 1949 had this to say, and it reflects technology. You know, he says, our aim should be to help the free peoples of the world through their own efforts to produce more food, more clothing, more materials for housing, and more mechanical power to lighten their burdens. While he didn't mention the word engineering in this quotation, clearly he's talking about technology and not just us giving technology to people, but helping people develop it and use it. One of the distinctions they make in their book is that humanitarianism is not humanism. You know, when I mention humanitarian engineering to some of my Christian friends, they get real nervous because I think I'm talking about being a humanist. And that has all sorts of interesting implications in Christian circles. They make the point that you could be a humanitarian from a wide variety of backgrounds. You can be a humanist and a humanitarian. You can be a Christian and a humanitarian. So there's lots of different reasons why you choose to be a humanitarian or a humanitarian engineer. There's a number of people they cite as having affected this work, some of whom are still alive. Frederick Cooney, if you haven't read about him, he was an interesting person. He's a civil engineer who did a lot of work in Guatemala, in Iraq, in Sarajevo right after the war there. And then he received a large grant to do some work in Chechnya about 20 years ago, in which time he disappeared. And it's believed he was killed by separatists in Chechnya, which is a breakaway portion on the border of Russia and Georgia. Maurice Albertson was an engineering professor in Colorado who contributed greatly to the founding of the U.S. Peace Corps. And Bernard Amadea is a professor at the University of Colorado and the founder of Engineers Without Borders USA. Now, I have a couple of quotations from these. Albertson says we needed to be motivated by service as well as profit. We serve best by finding out what people want and helping them work to realize their dreams, not by going into a country and telling villagers what they need. So we need to be sure we're not patronizing in our desire to help poor people, but doing what they need. In this very month's issue of Mechanical Engineering Magazine, they had a symposium about how can engineers help the world. And Bernard Amadea had this interesting quote. He says, I'm not going to dump another technology on the poor people of the world. That's a crime against humanity, and we do it all the time. It's not about technology. It's about empowering the poorest people in the world to get back on their feet, and with which I totally agree. So what would be a Christian's perspective on this? I think it may be more of a motive than of the specific actions. When I think of our trip to Haiti, I don't think the solar engineering things we did were uniquely Christian, but who we did them for and why we did them was. There is a biblical mandate, I think, for engineers using their skills. You see here Jesus in Matthew 25 talking about, to ask, when did we see you hungry or feed you or thirsty and give you something to drink? Because he mentioned that. And he replied, I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these, you did for me. A biblical verse that's become very significant to me in recent years is Jesus' statement in Luke 12, 48, where he says, from everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. Everybody in this room has been given remarkable skills, and God holds us accountable to use them in an appropriate way. So there is a broader Christian perspective. Just quoting Bible verses may not be enough for many Christians. How or even whether we're motivated to help may be the result of our basic theology. And that goes back to Niebuhr's book, Christ and Culture. And he attempts to categorize Christians. Any attempt to categorize people is not going to work completely because not everybody's going to agree with whatever category you come with. And he says that there. But it seems, he says, there seem to be some broad categories that have existed for a very long time. And these are his five. When he says Christ, he's really talking about the church. Christ against culture, Christ of culture, Christ above culture, Christ and culture and paradox, and Christ the transformer of culture. He strongly criticizes two and says generally positive things about three of them. I'm going to criticize the same two he did. I'll tell you the two that I like, and I'm not sure which one I'm really in. And there's one I'm not sure I understand well enough to criticize. Christ against culture said there's a fundamental opposition between Christ and culture. A few of you were in Dr. Halsmer's presentation earlier this morning, where he talked of what does Stuttgart have to do with engineering, with Jerusalem, which is kind of a paraphrase of Tertullian's comment, what does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? You know, philosophy and faith, how do you relate them? So these groups have been around a long time. Some of the monastics certainly had that, and many fundamentalist Christians of today have that attitude. The Christ of culture says Jesus is the hero of human culture, and to be in your culture and to be a Christian are basically saying the very same thing. When trying to give examples, I need to be careful because some of you may be from traditions, and I'm not trying to criticize any of you, but an example is within Anglicanism, which has many good things in it, there is a version of it which some people call the wide church view that says to be an Anglican and to be an Englishman is saying the same thing twice. If you're English, you're Anglican, or vice versa. And that is kind of saying Christ and culture is all together. Christ above culture, that Christ is separate from culture, enters into it in many ways, kind of looks down on culture, makes judgments on some parts, makes approval on some parts, and encourages people to act in the right way. Historically, probably the most well-known one who I would say strongly identifies in that category is Thomas Aquinas. And I would say many people, many Catholics, certainly not all, but many today would be in this category. This is one of the two that I'm not sure if I'm in or not in. Okay, I really like a lot of what this one has to say. Christ and culture in paradox. Christ and culture are different and they are in tension with each other. Niebuhr's definition here, he says, life must be lived precariously and sinfully in the hope of a justification which lies beyond history. And the most famous person that he associates with that would be Martin Luther. This is the one I'm not sure I really understand very well. So I'm not going to endorse it, but I'm not going to be really critical of it either. Then Christ, the transformer of culture. And Christ needs to transform culture, and there's various ways you could see that it's happening. Some would just see it as worldwide evangelization. Others would see it by being actively involved in culture and changing culture in a lot of different areas. There's a lot of examples. Certainly Augustine is seen as kind of the founder of this. John Calvin and many Reformed people are in this group. And lots, but certainly not all the evangelicals are in this group. So what is significant? I think how you see these affects how you wish to practice your profession. So now is where I make some judgments. If you're in the Christ against culture perspective, you probably will still feel a need to be honest and ethical. But if culture is terrible at all times and all places, do you really have a calling to help improve culture by improving poor people? I'm not sure you do. Now, if you're in this category and you do, I don't mean to upset you, but I just I'm not sure that you do. If you're in the Christ of culture, you may say, well, our culture is really pretty good. What do we need to do to change it? Let's just be a good engineer and make good gizmos. So these are the two that I think do not promote humanitarian engineering. And these are the two that Niebuhr himself criticized most strongly. This is the one that I'm not sure I really understand very well. If you're in the Christ and culture and paradox, you may want to help poor people, or you may just be worried about doing your job with the least amount of sin and not worrying about the rest of the world. So I don't want to criticize this view because I'm not in it, and I don't really know all the ramifications. I have Lutheran friends who are immersed in this and could probably say a lot more about it. The Christ above culture sees Christ sitting in judgment on a culture that doesn't always help poor people. You would probably feel a need to help poor people if you saw Christ sitting in judgment on you as a practicing engineer. And Christ transforming culture. One aspect is you may just see poor people as helping poor people as a means to an end. I think if you see anybody as a means to an end, you're not doing what you should do. I think we should be doing evangelization of everybody, whether they're rich or poor, but we need to see people as more than just objects. So this is an example of the Christ transforming culture that I would not endorse. But this is the one part of it I would. If you see engineering skills as capable of helping improve lives, you will be motivated to help poor people because that's the right thing to do. And evangelism can be a part of it, but you're not doing it just because you're trying to evangelize. So, as I try to put this together, I say that Christian humanitarian engineering requires an engineer who wishes to help poor people because that's intrinsically the right thing. And it can lead to evangelism, discipleship, and church growth. But you should be willing to do that even if these other things do not appear to result. So if I'm saying there is Christian humanitarian engineering, it's kind of implying that's a subset of both humanitarian engineering and Christian engineering. So some people would argue with me, including some of my friends, that there is no such thing as Christian engineering. So let me give my view of that. There's lots of Christian engineers. There's Christians who practice engineering. You ought to be hardworking. You ought to be honest. You create things that help people. I'd say Christian engineering is engineering practiced with the explicit goal of advancing God's agenda in the world. So Christian humanitarian engineering is a part of that, but you could be a Christian engineer and work for a major technology company too. So this is an example. I took this picture in January of 2008 just outside Kigali, Rwanda. And this is some kids pumping water. I don't know if those were pest control containers or not. They look like gasoline containers to me, which may be similar problems. So one of the questions is this a Christian water pump? And was the person who designed and installed it doing Christian humanitarian engineering? From my perspective, the answer to both of those is yes. So that also relates to something called engineering as mission, which is not the same as mission of engineering. The mission of engineering talks about using our Christian faith perspective and our skills in a way that honors God. And I think all Christian engineers are called to do that. Engineering as mission says we're going to practice engineering with the intentional goal of helping to advance the world mission of the church. So I see Christian humanitarian engineering as a subset of the engineering as mission. Something that's grown in the last few years is the concept of business as mission. I'm one of the many people trying to promote engineering as mission. But the point is, you could be practicing engineering as mission without necessarily concentrating on poor people. I think that's what emphasizes the humanitarian part of it. You could be doing this for all sorts of other things. You could be designing buildings, you know, for churches or whatever, and doing engineering as mission. So I would say that Christian humanitarian engineering is an example of engineering as mission that involves working with poor people. So it's more than just humanitarian engineering done by a Christian. And finally, I come to my definition, which quotes basically is very similar to the part of Mitchum and Munoz's definition. My definition finally at the end is Christian humanitarian engineering is the practice of engineering with the intentional goal of improving the well-being of underserved populations as part of our Christian calling to transform the world. So, what I've tried to do here is to develop this concept of Christian humanitarian engineering. A lot of what I've done has been from these two books, but not all of it. And it's clearly a work in progress. So, what questions do you have? Well, I think that there's some truth to that, and that's something I'm personally struggling with because for a long time I have been and still am premillennial. Yet the people who most influenced me on the Christ transforming culture through engineering have been my friends at Reformed colleges like Calvin and others, you know, and I've been very impressed with what they've done about the transformational aspect of engineering. So I agree with you, and that's an issue I'm still struggling with personally.